What's happening on April 15th?
No class.
No classes.
The Thursday, though. The ice of April.
Who's going to practice their presentation before they give it? How many teams think they're going to practice their presentation before they give it? And how are you doing those practices?
Peer review.
Right, but you're all going to sit around.
Breakout
room. I'm saying, is that what you're going to do? You really should do it as a formal. Sometimes the tendency is to sit around the laptop and just act like it's a presentation, but you really should actually do it in a formal thing like the tech center rooms or something. So, and I don't know how much time I'll have, but I mean, if you want me to attend, email me, and if I'm available, I don't mind attending if you want to get some help.
Can we present it on your big-ass TV in your office?
Sure.
Big-ass TV?
Yeah, that's what it is. That's the actual measurement.
Oh. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Joe, sure. Would you be able to give us some structural criticism, and then we can revise it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even if you just want to send me your slides and ask what I think, I can do that. It's going to be, the next 2 weeks are pretty hectic, but, you know, you guys are important, so I'll try. But you have a lot to fill in on these presentations, right? A lot of stuff that we haven't had time to go iterate through, like test specifications and things like that. So what I want to talk about today is really two topics, but they're related, standards and testing. So when you show up for your final presentation at the end of second semester and you're doing your demonstration, which you're going to do, this semester, I don't know how many of the teams are actually planning to demonstrate on the April 15th, but when you starting from your class, that'll be a formal part of the final presentation is a demonstration. And if you have a project that isn't amenable to demonstration, there's other things we'll do like videos or things like that. But when you do that demonstration, what's the most critical part of that demonstration? You know, the tendency is to say, well, see, it works. But I don't really care whether it works or not. What do I really care about? No.
What we're going to use to it.
If it meets the design constraints, thank you. So part of your demonstration should actually be a demonstration that you meet some of your critical design constraints. And therefore, what we'll talk about today are really our standards and testing. An important part of the project is the test specification where you describe how you're going to test your products or your systems. Because, as we'll talk about, the detail, there's always, you know, details are always are in the how you test. It's very easy to prove that your system or product meets tests you create, but it's very hard often to prove that it actually meets test specifications that are set by independent testing organizations. So if you go to work in industry and you develop technology, more often than not, that technology will be handed off to an independent testing group whose goal in life, you'll think, is just to torture you, because they'll be very anal about all the tests that they run and all this stuff, but there's reasons for that, and I want to talk about that a little bit today. So today we'll talk about standards and testing. There's some nice links here to information on that, and some of you should be able to use these websites to get some ideas about how you're going to test your products and what specifications you're going to need to meet. Here's an example of a safety shoe. If you want to sell safety shoes, do you just start building safety shoes and sell them in the stores?
Yes.
And if you do that, what happens pretty quickly?
Lawsuits.
Why?
Because they don't work.
Because? No, not quite. Because you claim to tested them. You said, you see, here's my brother, and we dropped a brick on his foot, and he was okay, so that was testing. Why are you going to get lawsuits?
Are there laws that say you have to wear shoes that...
No, close. The first part, there's laws that say what?
You've got to conform to certain standards.
You've got to conform to certain standards. And then you'll get the lawsuit because the user of that will claim that you didn't meet those standards if you don't say it, your product conforms to those standards. Now, if your product conforms to those standards, they'll still sue you, but it becomes a little bit harder if your product conforms to all the standards that govern that area. Now, one of the really, really interesting cases, I sent an email about it. I don't know if you've been following the Chinese drywall thing that's been going on for a while. I lived in Mississippi, so it was a big issue down there. But this was very, you know, very definitely a case of standards and testing. And it took, you know, several years to get the government and the Chinese government, the U.S. government, Chinese government to agree that there was a problem with this drywall. I think the story was that metal piping and other things behind the drywall was getting corroded. You could see like a black fungus or something was forming on it. And the claim was it was because of some chemical content, I think, in the drywall that was causing this chemical reaction. And this drywall was brought in when, I think it was like post-Katrina or something, when there's like a shortage on drywall or something. So it took quite a while to get the finger-pointing basically started. And like all things, initially they ignore the consumers until they realize the consumers aren't going to go away, and then it kind of ripples up. But there was a 60 Minutes segment on this, and now the government's finally said that they're going to have to gut all these houses that that have this drywall in them. So if you own a house with this drywall, it's worthless.
It's like a drywall recall.
Yeah, except you don't quite, it's hard to recall drywall. So, you know, these are, you've grown up in a world where this is very common. Think of how many times baby cribs have been with, you know, you wouldn't think a baby crib is very complicated, but think of how many times those have been recalled. Baby strollers, you know, every year now they seem to be recalling millions of baby strollers. There's the Toyota thing going on. I see cars are now getting smart gas pedals, which I don't even know what that means, but it's scary to think that my gas pedal has intelligence. You know, all this kind of stuff that you're going to be dealing with. So, that's not supposed to be there. So, standards generally go unnoticed. They're mostly quiet, unseen forces such as specifications, regulations, and protocols that ensure that things work properly, interactively, and responsibly. Now, this is a definition that came from somebody important. I don't know who this person is. But I would say that standards generally, I would actually disagree with this a little bit, that if you only meet standards, generally your product won't be useful because standards don't typically cover everything. They just try to cover some of the key things. So you could make, for example, we had a picture of the shoe earlier. You could make a shoe that meets the standards that the government requires, things like what happens if you drop something, you know, how strong it is, how much support it provides, how much cushioning it provides if something gets dropped on the shoe and all that. But that still may not mean it's a comfortable shoe to wear and it wears well and all those kinds of things. So standards, I think of it more as minimum compliance. These are some of the things you have to comply with to have a viable product. Now, one of the things that about half of the people in this room are going to be involved in is actually the formations of the standards. That's something that when you work in industry, you invariably get involved with. Your company has a strong interest in seeing how that standard is written. Why?
To meet it.
It impacts manufacturing.
It impacts manufacturing? What else does it impact?
Profit.
So give me an example of some valuable standards that you've dealt with.
It must not interfere with radio frequency devices, so that's blah, 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 blah.
Okay, that's an FCC type standard. What about in the way of entertainment?
PG-13, or the ratings, yeah.
No, not about ratings. What about file formats?
MP3.
MP3s and what else?
MP4s.
So tell me about MP4s. Who fought really hard to get MP4s established?
Apple.
Why?
Because they like it.
That made their machine somewhat unique. They were able to control market share by controlling that standard. And this is the real reason companies get involved in standards. They want to actually control the market through the standard. And in the old days, sometimes you would have situations where companies would explicitly own standards, like Sony tried to own some media standards early on with Beta and VHS, that kind of thing. That Beta and VHS was more a battle between Sony and the rest of the world than it was about Beta or VHS. The feeling was if the industry went with Beta, Sony was going to profit enormously because they own that format. So Apple's tried to do similar things with their QuickTime movies and MP4s and that, whereas the industry has gravitated towards MP3s and things like that. So companies have a strong interest in how these standards are created, and that's why many of you as engineers will participate on standards committees. And believe me, that's about the worst job I've ever had, is to be part of a standards committee, because you're trying to make a standard which satisfies a group of 30 companies. And it just becomes a mess because you've got to compromise in every which way to keep everyone happy. So what is a standard? Well, a simple working definition of a standard is a document, a thick document usually, developed and used by consensus of the stakeholders, companies for example, which describes how a product is to be obtained or used. The document can be electronic or paper. The stakeholders can include anyone with an interest without restriction. Product can include hardware, software, analysis result, test result, protocol definition. And obtained or used can mean designed, built, procured, calculated, tested. Now, sometimes standards are very, very specific. They will say things like, you must process this data through the system and you must get this result to be considered compliant. And they'll actually have formal testing processes like that. And only when you meet those kinds of tests will you be compliant with the standard. Other times they're much more nebulous and they have a lot of room for interpretation. The stakeholders can be a pretty diverse group. We had about a month ago or so, 3 weeks ago, the Marcellus Shale workshop, and one of the issues there, the stakeholders in that kind of an issue, you've got environmentalists, you've got industry, you've got government, you've got private citizens, and they're all trying to agree on standards for the removal of natural gas from this Marcellus Shale, and that's obviously a very politically sensitive issue. Features of an ideal standard, relevant and necessary by providing specific value to benefit the development of a product. Why do we want standards? So we talked about companies trying to own standards. That's pretty hard these days because we're pretty far along with our understanding of the value of standards. What's the good side of a standard?
USB.
Why? So what did USB standard do?
Got rid of all the crappy ports with all the pins. But
prior to USB, what did your junk drawer usually have in it?
SCSIs.
Not just SCSI cables, but
parallel cables.
You had adapters. You had every cable had some funky little pinout on the end of it.
You had the PS2.
You had serial cables that were round, were 9 pins, were 26 pins. Com cables. I mean, it was incredible. Now we have pretty much, USB has taken over. So why was there interest in making the USB standard? Companies fought this initially because prior to USB, companies were still thinking that the lack of a standard allowed them to have proprietary interfaces, which allowed them to get revenue by selling you special cables. What did USBs and what did a standard like USB enable?
Plug and play,
which means anybody. It enables a market, right? Because now all sorts of companies can make cables for that device, right? So a couple days ago, my daughters were home for spring break, and they brought home their iPods, and they were trying to show my wife how to charge her iPod, and they gave her a USB cable. And I said, well, I've got one of these things you plug into the wall, and it has a USB port on it. You can charge a device through, and it works very nicely with my USB player. So it's basically an electrical plug on one side and a USB port on the other side, right? Mm-hmm. Plug my MP3 player into it charges fine. Plug the Apple iPod into it, what happens? It doesn't charge. It's a USB compliant device, and yet Apple's chosen for whatever reason not to allow their devices to charge from it. So standards generally enable markets, and for some companies think that's a good thing because they can play in those markets. You have a lot of low-cost equipment manufacturers who can sell cables really inexpensively. And some companies feel that's a threat to their proprietary systems and standards and things.
So all those iPod docks and all the, things, do they have to pay Apple a fee for using the 30-pin connector?
Yes, generally when in a situation like that, Apple will want to control who their suppliers are, which is no different really than if you want to open up a franchise of a restaurant, like you want to open up a McDonald's. You just can't open up McDonald's. You have to get a license to do it. Same kind of situation. Now, and just to show you that this problem doesn't go away, recently we had the Blu-ray kind of standard came about, right? And that was still an example of a standard that was being pushed by one company, Sony. And there were several competing standards, but Sony was really pushing Blu-ray pretty hard, and it's eventually taken hold. Now, how did they do that? Did they sit in endless committee meetings trying to convince people to do this? No, they actually tried to push it through the marketplace. And you'll still see that even today, that some companies will try to circumvent the standards bodies. And we'll talk in a minute about who those are. Standards tend to focus on a specific concept. So you don't have a standard for an iPod. You have a standard for the various interfaces that you find on an iPod, the connectors, the media, things like that. So a product that you develop may have to conform to hundreds of standards to be functional. It's unambiguous, not subject to multiple interpretations. Very simple statement, very hard to achieve in practice without making the standard so specific that it's useless. Consistent. Auditable, and that's something we'll talk about today. It must be something that you can measure. A standard can't be something like it will work good. It has to be it will achieve a certain measurement. And that's one of the reasons why I've pushed you on your design constraints to make them quantifiable so that we can measure them with testing and experimentation. Some things that go into a standard or don't go into a standard. Best practices. Standards can actually be helpful because they're supposed to arise from best practices. And therefore, as a startup company, you can look to these standards as an easy way to acquire a lot of knowledge about the business very quickly. So you hope that standards reflect best practices in the industry. You hope that they reflect lessons learned. This is a hard one. When you enter an area like senior design where you don't have a lot of experience with standards, and you look at a piece of equipment and you say, well, that seems to be overkill, or I don't really understand why they space those things 1 foot apart. But then you'll find out, well, under some circumstance like a lightning strike or some anomalous behavior, that's what determines some of the safety factors in that specification. So they do try to capture lessons learned. They also tend to evolve. Now, this has been a big thing in the computer industry. You know, we had MPEG-1, MPEG-2, MPEG-3, MPEG-4. I was talking with Tim O'Rourke yesterday, VP of our computer services, and we were talking about the fact that in his business, which is running the university's computing systems, he's given up trying to guarantee that you will have access to your records for your lifetime. It used to be that universities were required to keep all their paper, right? So if 100 years from now, you want to go back to Temple and say, you know, show me my diploma, or show me my transcripts. Somebody would go into some room, file through all the cabinets and pull out your transcript, piece of paper, right? Today, that's virtually impossible to do electronically because the standards are changing so frequently. If you think about all the different versions of one of the areas where this is most critical is the digital camera memory, right? You look at all the different formats of these chips, and how many of them can we read today that existed 5 years ago? So, what?
Memory stick.
I don't know. I have a couple memory sticks I can't read on my laptop, and they're even though they plug in correctly to the laptop. And it's a mess. So standards do evolve, and that's a blessing and a curse. But you can be guaranteed that we'll have particularly with media, that they'll continue to evolve. Now, the CD standard has been actually fairly stable. It's considered one of the more successful standards because it's lasted for now like 20 years or something. But some of the newer standards are probably not going to last that long. Hopefully, when you make a standard, they try to make standards in ways that you can incorporate future evolution. Now, one of the tricks to that is to try to make your standards backward compatible. And this is another issue that you'll face when you're working with standards. Is it's not just to engineer the best standard, but it's often also to make that standard backward compatible with previous standards. So what's one major example today where there was a major disconnect between the new standard and the old standard? And it's something you guys got to happen in your lifetimes that won't happen for your children, probably. We just went through a big, big change. What? Television. What happened? Right. And what? And why was this such a traumatic transition? Because they decided not to make the new standard backward compatible with the old standard. And if you think about, you know, all the money that was spent, I mean, for how many years were you hearing about this? The government subsidized converter boxes. Even after all that, there was a little bit of a turmoil, and they had to extend the subsidies for converter boxes and things. A lot of political battling. There were lawsuits back and forth about, you know, who's discriminating against whom and all this kind of stuff. Very hard to change a standard like that. But why did they make that decision?
To free up the spectrum.
Because they wanted to not be hindered by the old standards, which were too inefficient in their use of bandwidth, because bandwidth is really precious and there's only so much of it.
And the government owns the best ones.
Well, the government owns bandwidth, which is a whole, if you take one of my courses, my signals course, I'll talk about that a little bit. The government thinks it owns the airwaves. And it actually sells spectrum at very high prices. Standards cannot be created for every situation. Sometimes necessary in real practice for subject matter, expert to extrapolate from one or more existing standards and design principles to solve a specific need. So, standards tend to, you try to make them in ways that they don't restrict, they're not specific to a technology, but you try to make them in a way that they can sort of bring some order to a industry. So you don't want to tell manufacturers how they have to make a device, but you want them to interface to everyone else's devices. So standards very often deal with the interfaces of your devices. And that's another thing many of you need to think about in your projects. You haven't done a good job yet of specifying that. What kind of standards your interfaces are going to conform to. For example, we have projects building wind turbines that are going to plug into generators and things. But there's been very little discussion about the electrical interfaces between those two systems. We have projects like the water percolator, which is has to get heavily involved with standards for drinking water. So, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of standards. Some standards deal with technical terminology. Some standards deal with materials. Some standards deal with test methods and test fixtures. Some standards deal with data. Some standards deal with statistical processes and so forth. Benefits of standards. There's a nice quote that the engine of national and global commerce is driven by standards. That's a really loaded statement, actually. So what's one of the most fundamental differences in standards you encounter when you travel?
Electricity,
right? What happens when you travel outside of North America?
More voltage.
They have different stuff, right? And how many of you own one of these wonderful little international travel kits for power that have like 14 different connectors on them, right? So when you step outside what are the basic standards for power in the U.S.?
110 volts
and
three-prong.
Second most important thing, we got the voltage right. The what? 60 hertz, right? When you step outside the U.S., what happens?
220 volts.
220 volts if you go to places like Europe. What happens if you go to a place like Japan? What?
Unstable current.
No. What about frequency?
75 hertz.
No, close. Go the other direction. 50 hertz. There's a lot of the world that uses 50 hertz. And I don't remember why this is, but I'm sure there's some justifications. So on a simple thing like electrical power, and this was a big problem when you carried your computers. Fortunately, laptops actually were one of the early devices to figure out it was in their best interest to work across all these different power standards. So laptops were purposefully built with power supplies that could operate from 220 to 110. 50 hertz, 60 hertz, because they're essentially AC to DC converters. That little brick that you carry around essentially does an AC to DC converter. So laptops kind of got it right. You don't have to worry about power, but a lot of devices weren't that fortunate. And that's
those things are expensive.
What?
When you have to replace your power adapter for a laptop?
Well, I think what happened with laptops, it was sort of fortuitous. They realized that a key thing with laptops was being able to carry it around. And a lot of the people who initially bought laptops traveled internationally, and they had enough of them, people would actually blow them up trying to plug them into 220 in the early days because the power supplies weren't rated for that. But then pretty soon, they started to come out with power supplies that operated across the whole range. Powers, you know, that's an example. Now, why did we end up in a world where there's not a universal power standard?
Edison.
Sometimes these things go back to technical debates. Sometimes these things go back to countries or sections of the world trying to protect their market share. So for many, many years, Europe, for example, had been resistant to adopting U.S. standards because the feeling was then U.S. manufacturers could flood Europe and basically take over all of their manufacturing businesses.
They have international standards?
Right. So we'll talk in a moment about some of the international organizations. So what did Europe do? Even when you traveled around Europe, you ran into differences in power. So What was another one of the major changes that happened in your lifetimes with the way Europe is organized? They created the EU. And one of the, what was the goal in creating the EU? Try to standardize things across all the European countries. So now you can carry a euro and you can spend that euro in any of the countries that are part of the EU. A monetary standard, very simple thing, but very complicated to negotiate. So it sort of goes both ways. You try to create international standards, but there's still a lot of political squabbling over international standards. Give me an example of an environmental issue where there's still a lot of haggling over international standards.
Kyoto Protocol?
The what?
The Kyoto Protocol.
Kyoto Protocol? Tell me about that.
The U.S. hasn't signed it.
Why?
Because they don't want to reduce their emissions by the target emission because they think industry will suffer.
Right. So you get a lot of these kinds of political, economic issues going. Standards try to enable this kind of economic development by reducing duplication of effort, bridging of technology gaps, reducing conflict and regulations, and so forth. Another very interesting thing is protection from litigation. When you get a patent, when you file, and we won't talk a lot about intellectual property here in Senior Design at Temple, but I used to talk a lot about that at my former school. When you get a patent as a U.S. company, where does that patent apply typically?
The U.S.
If you file it through the U.S. government, it applies in the U.S. Now, what does that mean? What are the implications of that?
China can take it.
China can take it. And under what conditions can China take it?
If they don't sell it in the U.S.
If they don't sell it in the U.S. So that patent only protects you for businesses operating in the U.S. That doesn't prevent businesses operating in other countries from violating your patent. So what do you do as a result of that? If you want coverage in these international, in the other countries,
file patents.
You have to go and file patents in those other countries. And this is a very complicated process, so you'll typically file a European patent, which will give you coverage across a bunch of countries, but there's still a lot of countries out there that sort of ignore all patent laws altogether. And this has been a big issue in areas like China with pirating of DVDs and things. It's been a big issue with pirating of operating systems and such. But generally speaking, standards and things help to protect you from litigation in an international marketplace. So why do practicing engineers need standards? So you're going to start your little company, or you're working at a company, and you're the lead designer on a product, like the space shuttle.
You know where to begin.
Space shuttle goes up one day, and it explodes. Whose problem is that? Well, obviously, I was going to say that. Aside from the people on board, whose problem is that? Big time problem if they're on board the shuttle, but.
The guy that signed off on it?
Your boss. Ah, there's a. So what happens? Obviously, lawsuits eventually come, right? The family of the victims sue you. A cascade of lawsuits start, actually, because NASA sues the contractors, the contractors sue their subcontractors, and, you know, just on and on it goes. Are you liable? Are you personally liable as the lead engineer on that project?
I don't know.
No.
Are you?
So if you're not personally, I'm sorry?
No, because you follow standards.
That's one good thing to point out. but you still actually may be liable. The liability, it's a complex issue. Very often, the company is liable, not you personally, unless they can prove that you did some things that were sort of illegal or that. It's a complicated issue. The lawsuit will actually get filed against it. Sometimes the lawsuit gets filed against the company. Sometimes the lawsuit gets filed against you personally. It just sort of depends on the case. Sometimes the company will provide you legal representation at their cost. Sometimes they'll tell you to go get your own lawyer. Now, if you've ever been, I hope you never have to go through these kinds of things, but if you get involved in one of these big lawsuits like that and you have to hire your own personal lawyer, you can basically go bankrupt trying to support that, because these lawsuits can get very expensive, millions of dollars in legal fees. So why do we need standards? Because one of the first things people are going to ask is, you know, was that space shuttle designed safely? And you're going to go back to all your tests and say, well, we met this standard, we met that standard, we met this standard. I did everything as lead engineer that I was supposed to according to these standards. And that's going to be one of your big defenses. Now, that's a bit of an extreme case, but the same is true when a product ultimately doesn't work. You deliver a product and all of a sudden people start reporting problems, like the Toyota problems. Your main defense as an engineer is going to be, well, you know, we met our design constraints. We designed according to standards. So we use standards to produce products efficiently. Delivered products must be designed and built. They make use of procured items and must themselves be procured. So when you procure items from a supplier, how are you going to enable that transaction? You're just going to call up the supplier and say, your senior design parts, for example. Next semester, you know, you've got you're down to the wire. You're going to put your last order in before your final presentations. What happens if those parts show up and they're defective? You're not going to be too happy. So how do companies prevent that?
Testing. Random testing.
When you order the part, you set specifications that often involve standards, and then very often you will actually randomly sample the parts that are coming in your door. So if you look at any large company that takes in, like an auto company or a semiconductor company that takes in large amounts of parts, they will actually randomly sample them and test them to make sure that the parts meet the quality specifications that have been imposed. So standards, that's another example of where standards come into play. Each of these phases, procurement especially, requires specification, and specification usually means documentation. So, you know, I know you all think you're doing a lot of writing in senior design. You're going to spend a large chunk of your career writing documents in engineering. And that's just a part of engineering. Effective specification requires standards. So think about that in context of your design constraints. So what you need to know as an engineer, purpose of the standards, the types of standards, the sources of standards, the development processes, who controls the standard, how to update or correct an existing standard, how to create new standards. When you're building a new product, you have a difficult situation. If you're building a new product that's really revolutionary, one of your fears is that when you come out with that product, people will say, oh, that's a good product. Let's all get together and create a standard for a similar type product that's different than that product so we can get a share of that market. So whoever's first out of the box with a product, very often that's not the ultimate standard. The standard will be made by a group of companies that want to make a standard that gives them a piece of the market. So they're going to want to differentiate themselves from that first product. That's, again, essentially what happened with Blu-ray. I think Sony may have been, or somebody like that, the only people out with Blu-ray. So they were hesitant to adopt it as a standard, and they were looking at other standards that were shared by more U.S. companies. So sometimes you want to go in and actually try to get the standard to be updated to reflect your emerging technology, but you want to do that in a way that you don't give away too much of the intellectual property associated with that technology. Types of standards. So there's a lot of different standards organizations. What are some of the major standards organizations in your disciplines? And I think I'll actually list some of them later. But let's start with civil engineering. Who are the civil engineers? We have a number of them. So where do you go to look for standards?
AISC.
The A?
ACI.
What are these? Spell out the acronym.
The military one.
Right, so there used to be these wonderful things called MIL-SPECs, which were military standards on top of the normal standards. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, these are sort of five types of standards. Specification, test method, terminology, practice. Now, the term specification is a little bit misused. There's often confusion about the difference between a specification and a standard. How would you describe the difference between a specification and a standard? And this doesn't really...
Specification, like a computer, is like, you know, 1 terabyte, and the standard's like IDE or SATA, something like that. You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking
about. Well, and then we also have this wonderful term of standard specification. Standards generally try to deal, it's sort of the difference between a design constraint and an approach. Standards try to deal with the generic implementation of the technology. They don't try to be very specific about a particular approach. Specifications can get very specific. So this, what you described is actually a good example that if you're going to buy a disk drive and you want standards to apply to the purchase of the disk drive, what are some of the standards that you're going to want that disk drive to conform to? The what?
Rotation.
No.
The connection.
Certainly the electrical interface, whether it's SCSI, whether it's IDE, SATA, these kinds of things. Right, and I would, and certainly something like, you know, is it a USB drive? Is it a internal drive? That kind of thing. What are some of the other things you might be concerned about?
The 3.5 inch, the 2.5 inch, the 1.8 inch.
USB, 7400.
Well, as a user, you're going to be concerned with speed, but I'll get to those issues in a second. More basic things.
Size.
What about power? Not really?
Yeah, because this drive doesn't take a lot of power. I mean, if you have enough, like, 800 watts.
Well, if it's an external disk drive. You're going to want it to be plugged into maybe 110, 220, maybe both. But why aren't you going to set a standard on the size of the disk drive? So we agree it should be powered by 110 volt. We agree it should have a USB interface, but why would you not want to set a standard on the size of the disk drive, the amount of data you can store on the disk drive?
Because it changes too quickly. That's where you make money. And
it limits you.
It limits you in what sense?
Creativity would set you
Right. So if you're a company that comes in with some magical new technology that spins at some speed, has some density, and stores bazillion bytes, that's a good thing, right? And that company shouldn't be prevented from selling into that application because their capacity is 10 times larger than what everybody else can do. Now, as a purchaser, you may specify, I want a 1 gigabyte disk drive or 1 terabyte disk drive. But in terms of standards, you would not want to specify the size of the drive because that's something that's going to be left to the manufacturers to optimize. So that's sort of what this is trying to talk about a little bit, the difference between standards and specifications. As a purchaser, you'll do a lot of specifications. As a developer, you'll generally develop to standards. So, standards organizations. It was interesting looking at this because I'm really out of touch with all the different standards organizations. But apparently, there is this sort of organization called International SDO, an accepted set of principles by which an organization engaged in the development of international standards must comply, has been adopted by the World Trade Organization and the Committee on Technical Barriers to Trade. Now, who actually listens to them, I don't know. It's really interesting to see which organizations people listen to. Certainly, you'll often hear ISO, which is one of the major standards organizations. Page ahead here. Yeah, okay, that slide. We'll go back to that. So we need some standard organizations for civil engineering. What about environmental engineering?
EPA
is a big one. Over what area does EPA rule? How wide is their reach?
What do you mean? US EPA.
US, when we, presumably when you said EPA, you're thinking US EPA, right? How far outside of the U.S. does the EPA reach?
Zero.
Not zero, no. No? So there's a lot of discussion about this issue of where the international boundaries are, so many miles offshore. There's still disagreement about how many miles offshore a country has rights to. Well, it's a dispute. They always seem to be disputing that kind of thing. So the U.S. is a unique stakeholder in standards, primarily because we represent a very large market. And I think, certainly for the past so many years in engineering, the U.S. has been able to dominate standards activities because of the U.S. market. Now, with emerging markets such as China, the game's changing quite a bit, and you're seeing the U.S. actually not able to drive as many standards as it used to. You'll also see a lot of, when you begin to participate in international activities, you'll see a lot of animosity towards the U.S. on some of these standards activities. But the rest of the world uses a politically driven, government-based standards development process, and typically ISO and IEC are at the top of this. So the International Organization for Standardization, ISO, this is one place that you'll go to look for standards. And they cover a broad range of technologies. And the U.S.-based entities are trying to be compliant with ISO, though you will find deviations from time to time. The American Society for Testing and Materials, which interesting now has become international, this ASTM International, it's the largest U.S.-based SDO with a substantial global participation. The Society of Automotive Engineers is another example. They began as a U.S.-based standard, but are now trying to promote themselves as an international standards organization. Give me an example of where you would see an SAE standard.
Oil.
Oil, right? And there's a little comment on the fact that the U.S. has driven a lot of standards in the past, but less so in recent years. So one of my favorite quotes about standards, this is something that used to be used at a company I worked at, was the good thing about standards is that there are many of them. A product should be designed to comply with industry standards. While the designing of standards does not ensure a safe product, standards do tend to create safer products. And one of the really sort of interesting issues with respect to advertising is how you advertise your compliance with standards or how you avoid advertising your lack of compliance with standards. And we've all kind of gotten some experience with this with infomercials where they try to show you how these products meet standards and provide unprecedented amounts of performance when in fact you buy them and get them home and find out that they don't do anything close to what they were demonstrating. So this, with this thought in mind, you know, think about this, how you're going to show me, how you're going to convince me that your senior design projects meet your design constraints. Because obviously you can configure those tests to be very favorable to you, to your product, your project, your. So we will pay some, we will look as you're, when you describe in your presentations in a couple weeks, you should spend some time describing how you're going to test compliance. And in describing those tests, you should be pretty specific. You know, don't just say we're going to do that, we're going to test for this. Explain actually how you're going to set the test up. Because usually when you look at standards, they actually describe how they're going to set the test up to show that you meet standards. So let's say you want to do something like get UL certification on your product. If it has a power cord in the U.S., you're going to need to get UL certification. When you go to get UL certification, they're going to tell you to go in a room, set your hardware up according to their test specifications. They'll have all the equipment there. You go in, you'll set your hardware there. Then they will tell you to leave the room. And then they will run the tests. And they'll tell you whether you passed or failed. And if you failed, then you have to come back another day. And these kinds of tests can be expensive. You can spend between $1,000 and $10,000 for just one shot at those tests. A friend of mine used to do this, and he actually had in the trunk of his car like a complete electronics shop because he had to make modifications on site when they went for certification. And there's always something little that they had to fix with when you dealt with things like FCC certification and such. So be very specific about how you describe the tests that you're going to run. Now, there's a lot of different kinds of testing that you can do. And I think, you know, hopefully you'll get, as we progress through the course, you'll get a better feel for all the different ways you can define design constraints for your systems. But many of you have talked about things like reliability in your design constraints. There's safety tests, reliability, functional tests. As engineers, we tend to think about functional tests, sometimes what we call unit tests. We tend to, mechanical engineers, we tend to think about things like packaging tests. But these days there's also issues like chemical content, construction materials, electronics. There's, depending on the type of product, there's a lot of different, you know, the tests will be very specific. So here's a couple examples. It's not uncommon to see on a piece of electronics trying to be marketed internationally to see all these symbols on it. These are all various standards organizations that have a say in that piece of electronics. If you look at a Dell power supply, you'll see all these kinds of symbols. And each one of these symbols more or less represents a different standards organization that has certified that piece of equipment. So standards imply certification by testing, which means to meet a standard, you're going to have to do some testing to prove that you met that standard. And in some countries, it's required, actually, that if you market a product, you have to pass certain standards. That's been, I would say, more true in Europe than it has been in the U.S. But even in the U.S., there are certain standards. You'll rarely see a product, for example, marketed without a UL certification on it.
I think
the U.S. is pretty lax that you can sell products that do not have these certifications. But the problem is, if you do that, you're going to get sued within minutes. So companies like Underwriters Laboratories, it's been debated for many years, is their standard really meaningful? But they make a lot of money because everyone pretty much has to get their certification if your product has a power cord on it.
What do they?
That's a good question. What are some of the things that, if you're going for certification of a power cord, what are some of the things you're going to want to test? You're going to certainly test nominal voltage and frequency and things like that, but make sure those pass through the power cord properly. You're going to test that it doesn't get too hot, so you're going to leave this thing running for a while and measure the heat. Those are all pretty straightforward. What are some of the other things, though, that actually go into UL certification? What other kinds of tests might you want to prepare for? So who's used an electric appliance outdoors? Grounding?
Like a toaster?
What about water? Who's run an extension cord through water? I think if you've done work outside with electrical appliances, you've probably done that, right? Or if you're like, you know, if you've got like a string trimmer or a hedge trimmer and it starts raining out, you usually don't stop until the rain's pretty bad, right? So the certifications also deal with some of these uses about wetness, moisture. One of the big ones is over voltage protection from electrical impulses. When there's thunderstorms and things, you can actually measure rises in the voltage on your power cords because of all the electromagnetic energy. So they have specifications about what kinds of voltages you must be able to protect against to get UL certification. So if there's a lightning strike of a certain magnitude, all your equipment will still survive. Now, testing is not only just for standards, but testing is also to help you understand, you know, really to determine if your product is going to be successful. So tests are designed not just to meet standards, but you also want to understand what we call common use cases. Now, this is a very well-developed area for software. If you ever go into an area like software engineering, you'll spend a lot of time learning about test procedures. But with physical products, it's a little more open-ended. But it's very important when you're building systems that you test them for both proper and improper uses. In fact, improper uses is usually where you get into problems with a lot of products. For example, children's toys. What's one of the most common things that catch manufacturers of children's toys?
Loose parts,
right? You sell that Barbie doll, and you know, you sell it as one piece, and you say this is wonderful. Child rips the head off the Barbie doll and eats it. And you've got a lawsuit on your hands, right? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that happens. So you have to test for improper uses. And oftentimes that's done in a number of ways. You try to predict these things. Sometimes it's actually done by focus groups where you just give the products to people, prototypes of them, and you watch them actually use them, and you try to figure out, you know, what they're going to do wrong. So here, I have just a couple slides on an example of safety of toys. Because that's a really, if you ever get a chance to work on toys, it's a really fun area. But it's just loaded with a lot of these kinds of issues. So step one, emulate users of the toy under various situations, normal and abnormal. Analyze and study the features, functions of the toy. Identify the potential hazards of playing with the toy, including packaging. So yes, there are companies that will actually, many of the really good toy companies have demonstration labs where they bring children in and they actually let them do everything starting with unpacking the toy and learning how to use it. And they actually observe them with cameras and things to try to understand all the potential problems. And it's hilarious. I mean, when I worked at Texas Instruments years ago, we did a little bit with consumer toys. So it's hilarious to hear the stories of what children do with early prototypes of these toys that you didn't think they would do with them. But then once you've done that, there's a large body of standards documents. So you look for standards and confirm the test criteria. So in this case, there was a particular standard identified for toys, this EN71, and if you look that up in the documents pertaining to that standard, you'll see actually a whole slew of substandards relating to that standard. And this is just a piece of the matrix that came from that, but there's just all sorts of specifications on chemicals and materials, flammability, and all those kinds of things. And you'll have to construct tests. What will actually happen at your company is that they'll have a test engineer who's going to take your product and write these tests for your product, and then you're going to have to check as the engineer to make sure that the test engineer did the right thing. And there's a lot of negotiation back and forth because the test engineer generally looks at things in a more generic way and won't really know all the details of your test. So what you'll do then is you'll construct a test for each one of these standards associated with that product and that particular standard. And generally, depending on the type of product you're producing, you'll find an area like this. So, for example, this EN71 applies to consumer toy products. So if you worked in that industry, you would know about this standard. Now, there's a couple other standards that are becoming critical. And one is this restriction of hazardous substances, which essentially deals with, there's a nice little graphic here about all the different kind of phases in product use and the different standards it applies. But there's this ROHS and this WEEEE. The ROHS tries to deal with sort of the chemical composition of the toys and tries to, and these guidelines are things that are set based on studies about health hazards and that kind of thing. And your product then will have to conform to these standards. We've seen a lot of this recently with chemicals given off by plastics as they degrade. It's been a hot topic. And these kinds of standards are attempts to abide by those standards. And notice that sometimes as the product ages, the chemistry of the product changes. That's another one of the really difficult things to predict. So, you know, that baby bottle, when you sell it brand new, may not leach chemicals. But 3 years later, it may start to leach chemicals. So, and a whole other area we won't do much with in this course is what's called accelerated life testing. But that's a really important part of test engineering, is how to take a product and in a period of a month, simulate what's going to happen over a period of 10 years. And there's quite a bit of science about how to do this through what's called accelerated life testing. And then there's also the waste from electronic equipment standard. This more deals with what happens when you throw that thing away and it sits in a landfill. And these are examples of two sort of environmentally oriented specs that actually impact directly things like electronics products. So this is another reason why I know it's painful to build multidisciplinary teams in senior design, but all the products you're going to work on when you get out of here, all the projects you deal with are going to have environmental issues attached to them. You can't really escape this stuff anymore. So that's a little bit about testing and standards. Every senior design project should address standards relevant to its discipline. The design constraints must be tested through tests described in the test specification document. The results of the tests must be reported in the test certification section. The data associated with these tests should be archived on your website. So you might think about creating a section on your website for testing where I can go and look at information like your test setups, the data that you collected during the tests, when you ran the tests, all that kind of stuff. Just like what you've been doing in the lab with your lab reports. And then also the final project demonstration should do a live demonstration where you show that you meet some of your critical design constraints. Okay, so we won't meet next week because you're going to have the presentations on Thursday. So I'm sure we'll be in touch before then, but good luck, and hopefully we'll have a good day a week from Thursday. All right. Thank you.